It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin is well known for its conservation history. We talk with an historian who says the Walker administration is reversing the gains of the state's legendary conservationists.
First, President Trump and his children have been at the center of controversy this week. The president's son, Donald Trump Jr., recently released emails between himself and British music publicist Robert Goldstone. In the emails, Goldstone said a Russian official could give the Trump campaign disparaging information about Trump's then-opponent, Hillary Clinton.
Goldstone eventually set up a meeting between Donald Trump Jr., other Trump campaign members, and a Kremlin-connected attorney. The emails and the meeting have added another layer of questions to an ongoing investigation on the Trump campaign's ties with Russia. You can share your thoughts on the Trump email controversy now at 800-642-1234 or by posting on the Central Time Facebook page.
Paul Singer is the Washington correspondent for USA Today. He joins us now to recap that story and other big stories in national politics. Paul, welcome back.
How you doing, Rob?
Well, good. Now, the story, the Russia investigation has a lot of different pieces to it. One, did Russia interfere in the U.S. election? People seem to agree yes, and they're figuring out how. But this issue of collusion has been much more of an open question. What do these emails tell us about the whole collusion angle in this ongoing story?
Well, it's a difficult thing to say about whether there was collusion. What the emails show us definitively, and I think this is the first problem for the Trump administration, is that there were meetings between people connected to the Russian government and members of President Trump's, well, then-candidate Trump's campaign, despite their denial that any such meetings had happened. So now we confirm the meeting happened. We also confirm in those emails that it was made very clear in those emails that this is assistance being offered by the Russian government and several people, including the campaign chairman at the time, Paul Manafort, agreed to take the meeting anyway. So it doesn't prove collusion in the sense that, you know, it's not clear from these emails that candidate and team asked for assistance or received direct assistance from the Russians. But it certainly casts a lie to things that the Trump people have been saying about this whole scandal for the past 6 months. They said nothing ever happened. There were no meetings. We didn't meet with the Russians. That's not true.
Now, Sean Hannity of Fox News asked Donald Trump Jr. about his initial reaction to the email he got. Here's a listen to what he had to say.
This email comes in. What are you thinking?
Honestly, my takeaway when all of this was going on is that someone has information on our opponent. You know, things are going a million miles an hour. You know what it's like to be on a campaign. We just won Indiana, but we're talking about a contested convention. Things are going a million miles an hour again. And, hey, wait a minute. I've heard about all these things, but maybe this is something. I should hear him out.
That's been a defense here. Hey, this is just a campaign looking for information about their opponents. Other people saying when an agent of a foreign power comes to you with this kind of information, you go to the FBI. Can you talk about some of the range of response we've seen to this just in the last day, I guess, Paul?
Well, everybody does opposition research. Donald Trump Jr. is correct that there is nothing unusual about a campaign getting information from all kinds of sources that suggests something nefarious about the opponent. The trouble with this one is, A, that opposition research usually goes on with a contractor or a consultant who is an expert in this kind of material. They usually vet the material themselves. It almost never rises to the level of a meeting with the campaign chairman. In this case, the whole process took like a week to get from, hey, would you like help from the Russian government to beat Hillary Clinton, to, yeah, let's sit down and meet with the campaign chairman. That's not standard. It's not traditional. It's not normal. You could make the case that the Trump campaign, nothing was normal because they just didn't do stuff. They didn't know anything about politics, and that's part of their argument, is we were a bunch of rookies. Maybe, but Paul Manafort was certainly not a rookie. He had run several Republican conventions for Bob Dole before. He knew exactly what the rules of the road were, even if Don Jr. didn't. So it's a really thin nail to hang your defense on that, well, we were just like everybody else looking for information about our opponent.
And then one surprising element of the story is Donald Trump Jr. releasing the email thread himself after finding out that the New York Times had these emails, it looks like. But this, him putting it out there, takes away the whole fake news argument, or the argument that the story here is the leaks, if he put it up there himself.
Yeah, thank God for Twitter. I mean, this is one of those days when you're just like, really? The guy just put out a bunch of these emails that look incredibly incriminating on Twitter for him to read? That was outstanding. I enjoyed every minute of that. It's just, you know, America's gotten weird, Rob. It's just, this is not the way you do these things if you are seriously trying to, you know, manage the response.
Talking to Paul Singer from USA Today and our weekly look at the latest from Washington. Our starting point today, the Donald Trump Jr. Emails and meeting that's getting a lot of attention this week. You can join in with your thoughts on that at 800-642-1234. So, Paul, a lot of people are talking about, well, what unanswered questions do we have? What is next? What are you watching for in this story?
Well, I will say something that will sound sort of contentious, and I don't mean to be, but nobody ever cheats once. I mean, this is sort of my theory of covering members of Congress for years and years and years and years and years, is that people don't cheat once. If they have behavior like this, tends to follow other behavior like this. So what I'm looking for is any suggestion of any similar meeting or any similar outreach or any similar failure by the Trump campaign to respond properly to outreach from the Russians, right? I mean, that's basically the gist, is we now have proof there was a meeting and that the meeting was offered on the pretense of the Russians want to help you get elected. So my question is, how many more of them are there out there that look like this? And if there's more than this one, it's a problem.
And, of course, I guess the gold standard of finding out what's going on would be Robert Mueller's investigation. We, of course, don't know what's happening there. But is there any concept of when or how active this investigation is from Robert Mueller and this team he's been assembling?
When? No. But it's active. I mean, there is no doubt that they are pursuing this stuff. And you're right. We have no idea how much more they have and what else they're looking at. Keep in mind, we believe they may also be looking at some financial transactions that the Trump family has been involved with overseas. We have reason to believe they are looking into whether President Trump crossed some sort of line when he fired James Comey. Was that an obstruction of justice? This is just getting bigger. This investigation continues to show smoke that may be leading to something. And I, you know, I don't know anything about what Robert Mueller is looking at today, but I have every reason to believe they are being very, very thorough and taking this all very seriously.
Let's go to our callers now. Ted is on the line in Monaco. Ted, hi.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear you have a guest there who's on who seems really knowledgeable about this. And I'm wondering what his professional opinion would be. Yeah, what would happen if the government spent its time and money investigating rather than this Russia thing, you know, which seems to be a dead end? If they look into alternatives for health care and tax relief to bring, you know, corporate orders, headquarters, these businesses home to America, so there'll be places to work. You know, Russia is always involved in our elections. We're always involved in their elections. Our President Obama even tried to overthrow the leader of Israel, who was on our side, you know, on the civilized side of things of the world. And so I'm wondering what his opinion would be if the government actually did the work of the people instead of always trying to play gotcha with the other side. And, you know, they're investigating something, they found no crime, and yet they're still investigating things. They keep looking for things, and it's just kind of tiresome to the point where everyone just turned the news off and they realize it's congressmen, just a bunch of fakes.
Ted, thanks for the call. A lot there, Paul, but the gist, wasting our time on this dead end, our money and effort is better spent.
Yeah, I actually have that quote in my notebook from every Democrat talking about the Benghazi committee last year. You know, this all of the allegations of, you know, partisan witch hunts are now coming out of the Republicans that were coming out of the Democrats a year and a half ago. It leads me to believe that your view of a witch hunt depends on which party the witches are who are being hunted.
Thanks for the call, Ted. We go next to Scott on the line in Milwaukee. Scott, hi.
Hi. I just I'm listening to the story, and I've heard a little more about the story in the sense that, I mean, it seems like you guys are basically saying half the story, because when this woman even yesterday said that she was not a Russian agent, and she basically said that the reason why she didn't want to come there about any collusion about, well, Hillary Clinton, she basically was going there for changing the Russian law about adoption between Russia and America. And whether that, you know, was the initial way she came in or not, and I'm sure it wasn't. I'm sure she probably said something to get their attention. But the problem I hear is the non-talk about the rest of the story on your station. It's like fake news is not something that's just false, but it's also a omission of the complete story. And the complete end of the story is that they were in the office for a matter of minutes, and they found out she had nothing, and they said, okay, that meeting's over.
Scott, thanks for the call, and that is the story as presented by Donald Trump Jr., Paul.
Right. Well, this is the problem. I think the caller is right. You know, we need to know the rest of the story. Given the fact that Donald Trump Jr.'s description of this meeting changed 3 times in 2 days, and given the fact that he is potentially in some legal jeopardy, I don't believe that his current version of the story should be accepted as the final version of what happened. I'm not saying that's not what happened. For all I know, that is what happened. But I think we need to learn a little bit more before we just decide, well, there was nothing there. Because if nothing else, what we do know in writing was an email saying, hi, the Russian government is trying to help you beat Hillary Clinton. You want to meet? And they said, sure.
Thanks for the call, Scott, at 800-642-1234, as we talk to Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for the USA Today. We're recapping some of the top stories in national politics this week.
And you can tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page, what are your reactions to the emails that Donald Trump Jr. released? Do you think they signal collusion with Russia or not? And what do you think of Republican efforts to push back the August recess to keep working on the health care bill? Call in 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Kay Dartcher-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our weekly look at national politics with Paul Singer, Washington correspondent with USA Today.
Tell us what you think of some of the top stories in national politics at 800-642-1234. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page. What were your reactions to President Trump's initial plan of working together with Russian President Vladimir Putin on a cybersecurity unit? Do you think it was a good idea? What were your reactions to Ivanka Trump's role at the G20 summit? Was it her right for her to sit in briefly for the president at a meeting with top global leaders? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Paul, before we move on from the email story, Kimmy in Reedsburg called, couldn't stay on the line. She said our elections were put in jeopardy by the Russian interference. This is, she says, a concern for everyday citizens, and it's a worthwhile use of our resources. Paul, that's the other side of the spectrum from some of the callers we heard from earlier.
Right, and I think that the congressional investigations particularly accept that as the baseline, that as long as they're concerned about the Russian meddling in the elections, no matter who it was intended to benefit or no matter whether there was any kind of collusion with the Trump campaign, those are almost secondary issues. I think as a national security matter, we need to get a better understanding of how much jeopardy was our election system. Was there something going on? And if so, how do we defend ourselves in the future? And I think those are valid questions that no matter what your party is, at least on Capitol Hill, they are very serious about pursuing.
I want to move on to a couple other issues in the news this week, Paul. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell delayed the chamber's August recess to work on the health care bill, among other things. What are they hoping to get done in the extra, 2 weeks that they haven't gotten done so far?
Well, apparently they're hoping to destroy my vacation, so that was good news. But beyond that, the theory is that they will finish off the health care bill in the next week, and then after that, they will still have time to work on a defense authorization bill. There is some possibility they will try and solve a debt ceiling or other fiscal matters. There's a lot of stuff still on the plate that the Senate has to get around to, and so the sort of back story here is, or the other possibility here is, what if they fail to pass health care? Are they just buying themselves a couple extra weeks to pass something else that would look like a solution before they go home? Still, we don't know if they're actually going to stay, right? I mean, they might decide at the end of July they finished everything they need to finish and they can go, but they are clearly buying themselves some time to get some achievements under their belt if healthcare fails.
And what is the state of the art in an effort to pass something on healthcare in the Senate?
What time is it? I mean, it's really every hour it changes. All I can tell you at this moment, we have not seen, there have been 10 senators who have been, Republican senators who have been opposing versions of the bill as it's been kicking around. We have not seen anything that changes that math significantly enough to suggest that they've got the votes they need to pass the bill. We're supposed to get another version of the bill tomorrow, that's Thursday. We shall see if that makes a significant change in the way senators are looking at it, but we have heard nothing at this point that implies that there are 50 votes to pass this thing. So something dramatic would have to happen in the next week for them to actually get this thing to the floor.
I understand Senator Ted Cruz had been involved in some of the newest changes, possibly allowing kind of lower budget versions of health care plans to be sold, and
right,
that he was part of the team that was going to be kind of being a Senate whip trying to conjure up votes. Some people said Ted Cruz, whatever you think of him, not necessarily popular even among fellow Senate Republicans.
Right. Yeah, he had been part of the negotiating team at some point earlier, about 6 weeks ago. We'd written a story about the unusual transformation of Ted Cruz into the sort of bastion of compromise. At this point, it's hard to tell. Senator Cruz has said, basically, as you said, he's got this language that would allow states to, or allow insurers to sell insurance plans that don't comply with Obamacare, as long as they are also selling Obamacare compliant plans. Very controversial proposal. Senator Cruz has said basically he would support the bill if his language is in the bill. He doesn't want to have to bring it to the floor as an amendment because he doesn't think it'll pass. So again, until we see exactly what the text is, we're not sure who's supporting which provisions in the bill. And, like I said, we don't know what the amendment process might be and how they might be able to add stuff.
So one national news story, Paul, that probably went in at the top of our list since last week, President Trump met President Putin, and they talked about a lot of things, Syria and cybersecurity. And President Trump made a push for, and he tweeted about this, a cybersecurity unit working with Russia. And that was just in a tweet, but that got a lot of reaction when he tweeted that out. Can you talk about that?
Well, it was only a tweet until the Secretary of State then came out and explained further that we're putting together this task force with Russia to work on cybersecurity, which everybody described as the hen house security effort we are taking on with the Fox. And it was what made it even weirder is that a couple of days later, after a lot of bipartisan criticism, Donald Trump tweeted that just because we're talking about this kind of a task force with Mr. Putin doesn't mean we can do it. We can't. So nobody's really clear what they have in mind. It was just odd. The whole thing was just odd. And honestly, I cannot tell you at this point whether they have any intention of putting together such a committee or not.
And Republican Senator Lindsey Graham had a strong reaction. Here he is on Meet the Press.
It's not the dumbest idea I've ever heard, but it's pretty close. He gave a really good speech in Poland, President Trump did, and he had what I think is a disastrous meeting with President Putin. 2 hours and 15 minutes of meetings. Tillerson and Trump are ready to forgive and forget when it comes to cyber attacks on the American election of 2016.
So I know it's not really what people are talking about anymore, but reactions in Washington to the Trump-Putin meeting, Paul.
You know, and the problem with this is exactly what Senator Graham refers to, and that is that you lose the fact that the President of the United States went to Poland and gave a very dramatic speech about the importance of American power and how he was planning to, you know, support the alliances, but there's going to be a new sheriff in town, basically. You know, that was an important speech for the President, and it was quickly trampled over by all of this. You know, honestly, in Washington, Trump-Putin meetings, et cetera, have all been drowned out by these emails. Trump-Russia is taking the wind out of the entire agenda at the moment, and it's just going to be that way for a little while until the next shoe drops.
Another story that came out of the trip to Europe, Ivanka Trump sitting at the table for President Trump briefly in an important meeting. We have a caller, Peter in La Crosse, on that. Peter, hi.
Hi.
What did you think about that?
Well, my analogy for that would be, would a CEO of a corporation, a hospital, or whatever company might be, have a serious business meeting with other companies, allow his daughter to sit in? Here's supposedly the leader of the free world in the United States allowing his daughter sit in on a conference with, that to me, it doesn't make any sense.
Peter, thanks for the call. Paul, your thoughts on that one?
You know, Ivanka's not the average daughter. She is a senior advisor to the President of the United States, and you can make the argument about, you know, nepotism and should he be relying on his family, whatever. All of those are perfectly fair conversations to have. But once you sort of get past the notion of that question, what you are really asking is, should a special assistant to the president sit in his seat for a period of time during those meetings? Maybe not. But I'm not particularly blown away by it. It's unconventional. But again, the whole Trump presidency is unconventional, so I'm not sure that, I'm going to call the appropriations police or whatever you'd call them, who are supposed to look over the manners of people at these meetings.
We'll leave it there for now, Paul. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Have a great one.
That's Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today. He joined us for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics.
Those of us attending the state fair next month will notice a reduced presence for the State Department of Natural Resources. Its two-acre exhibit will be cut down into a smaller area called Exploratory Park. The DNR says they remain committed to the fair, but on a smaller scale.
But our next guest says he thinks it's part of a pattern showing an effort by the department to retreat from public outreach education. He says that trend, along with legislative efforts on the environment, is taking Wisconsin far away from its long history of conservation.
John Gerda joins us now. He's a Milwaukee-based writer and historian. He's written 21 books, including The Making of Milwaukee, which was the basis for an Emmy Award-winning documentary series. He also recently wrote an opinion piece for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on the DNR in Wisconsin's environment. You can find it on the Central Time Facebook page. John, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here, Kate.
Well, let us begin with the state fair that opens August 3rd coming up. And the DNR is saying it will have this diminished presence there this year. What do we know about how it will differ from what they've done at the fair in the past, their tradition?
I think all they're doing is promoting state parks and natural areas and the fish tanks and the ponds and the smoky schoolhouse and the forestry exhibits, the wildlife exhibits, all that will be gone, even though it was very largely, volunteer hours put in by DNR employees. Instead, there will be the UW Extension. Master Gardeners will have some exhibits there, but it won't be the same, you know, as kind of the showcase for Wisconsin's resources that have been there for close to 70 years, you know, so it really has been a part of the state fair tradition.
And the DNR has cited smaller budgets, smaller staffing leading to this decision?
Well, when you cut budgets and you cut staff, you know, this is a self-inflicted wound. And I think the pattern that is very clear here is that since the Walker administration has taken over the DNR, they've acted, in my opinion, much like foxes in a hen house. You know, there have been rather drastic cuts in the staff. There are fewer employees, investigating fewer complaints and issuing fewer citations. So it's I'm not saying that it's been completely sold to corporate interests, but there's been just a sea change in the way the DNR approaches its task of protecting and promoting Wisconsin's natural resources.
And what do you see as some of these incidents, some of these turning points thus far that you have seen during the Walker administration from the DNR in its tradition of being this public outreach element?
Some are certainly related to staffing. Early on, they cut the scientific staff. You know, on the basis of science is what you hope the decisions will be founded on. But then there are just some ham-handed, sort of head-shaking kind of moves. Trying, for instance, to cut out the Natural Resources magazine, even though it was self-supporting and cost, I think, less than $10 a year for six issues. So just these things that seem almost gratuitous, petty, kind of small-minded and mean-spirited. And I think, to me, it kind of indicates a lack of willingness to engage and an interest in kind of blunting the message. And it's not just climate change. You know, it's kind of the respect for the environment that's been just a huge, huge part of the Wisconsin tradition.
Let's talk a little bit about environment and the DNR's approach to protecting the environment. Have you seen the decision-making there change as well?
The article in the Journal Sentinel a couple of weeks ago got a number of emails, and yes, you know, there were comments from people who had direct experience, everything from the full-time naturalist complement in the entire state is now four people who are interpreting our natural resources to the public at nature centers and other public facilities. Got an email from a retired game warden who said that there's been It's kind of been open season for poaching, and some of the regulations have been adopted. He said, you know, it's just boggles the mind. You know, he said that in the previous regulations, if a warden found a hunter in a tree stand with a loaded rifle at midnight watching a large corn pile, he could issue a citation. Now the warden cannot unless he's there and physically watching the hunter in the act of shooting. So it's kind of, he said it was just, as a retired warden, you know, someone who was just dismayed at the changes. Another woman, you know, got called and said that they're up there in Rock Island, state park there off the tip of Washington Island, and there were buildings that were crumbling, and there were signs saying repairs to be completed in 2016. Here we are in 2017, and there had been nothing done. So yes, you know, I don't have a handle on as sprawling as an agency as the DNR is, but there are very clearly, and people are seeing, you know, the signs of kind of a deterioration in mission and in facilities.
We're talking right now with John Gerda. He is a Milwaukee-based writer and historian. Recently wrote an opinion piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the DNR, changes in the DNR and Wisconsin's environment, and also in the conservation tradition you have seen in the past. Let's take us to conservation and its rich history of environmentalism and conservation. When did this tradition start, John?
Back in the years, even before statehood. So you have people early on, back in the mid-1800s, and these are national figures, some 19th century, some in the 20th as well. People like Increase Lapham, pioneer scientist who had an major impact on starting the U.S. Weather Service and was the mapper of Indian Mounds in Wisconsin. John Muir, who was the founder, or a founder of the National Park System, as well as the founder of the Sierra Club. He was raised on a Marquette County farm, later moved to California, but he talks about the lessons of the Wisconsin wilderness, you know, were his practical education. Charles Whitnell, who's the father of Milwaukee's park system that is one of the finest in the entire country, and the very famous Aldo Leopold, whose Sand County Almanac is kind of a Bible of the environmental movement. Gaylord Nelson, Senator, Governor, who was the founder of Earth Day. And you look at that, I call them a pantheon of environmental all-stars. And for a state our size and population, that is just a huge contribution to the cause of conservation, both nationally and internationally. I don't think California or New York, you know, have that that distinguished a group of people who were trying to protect the environment.
And Aldo Leopold, specifically, he wrote about the land ethic, this idea that inspired those who came after him. What was this land ethic, and are we following it today?
The land ethic, very simply, is trying to turn around, Leopold was trying to turn around the concept of land as a commodity that belonged to us, and instead see ourselves as belonging to a community that was based on the land. So kind of not what we own, but what we belong to. And that really is a sea change, and that inspired Nelson, among others, and certainly is, you know, has kind of a global repercussions. You know, he is a revered figure around the world. But I would say, as I said in the article, you have this on the shoulders of these giants, you know, like Leopold and Nelson. We now have a gang of Lilliputians who are in charge of our natural resources. So I do see a rather wholesale retreat from that ethic.
Lisa on Facebook says, I'm glad I got to be alive and experience the results of these original conservationists who actually made America, and specifically this state, great before our current leaders undo it all. What role should this history play in our decision-making today?
I think it should be the ballast. It should be the keel that directs our decision-making. And this is not that, it's fairly recent. You know, this is the changes have been fairly recent. You know, you have in the, not too many decades ago, you have people like Warren Knowles and Gaylord Nelson, a Republican and a Democrat, both very interested in conservation, both interested in putting aside prime environmental land for the use of the public. So you have the Knowles-Nelson Stewardship Fund that has set aside something like 600,000 acres for us, that is our land, and the Republicans are trying very hard to dismantle that program and kind of channel it to other sources. Kind of the promise was to use it to fund scholarships for Wisconsin students to UW, but it's kind of, as I said, it's kind of mixing poison with honey, and it would end, you know, that program. So I think you look at history as kind of why things are the way they are, and we have this long tradition, and my hope, my sincere hope, is that the current administration is out of step with what is still an enduring and durable Wisconsin tradition, and the pendulum will swing back, and even in the near future, people will realize kind of what's being lost and what is being threatened, and return to this, the values we held for so many decades before.
We're talking with Wisconsin historian John Gerda about his concerns over the direction of the state's environmental policy and the DNR straying from Wisconsin's long tradition of conservation.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the DNR's decision to cut back their presence at the state fair? Was that an exhibit you've attended in the past? How do you think Wisconsin's history of conservation and environmentalism should affect our decisions today? Do you think cuts to things like state parks and the DNR scientific staff are tough but necessary choices in making the budget work? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with writer and historian John Gerda. His recent opinion piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel says the DNR's decision to cut back its presence at the state fair is part of a troubling trend away from the state's history of environmental protection and conservation.
And we want to hear from you. What are your thoughts on the DNR under the Walker administration? Are you concerned about the environment as scientists are cut from the department and outreach programs are trimmed down? Or do you support streamlining the DNR through budget cuts? If you hunt, fish, or just love the outdoors, what parts of the environment do you think need our protection? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. John, you described the DNR as a sprawling agency. Is a large agency, can that be sustained? I mean, there are tight budget times. Is this inevitable that an agency would be slimmed down?
I don't think so. I think it's the nature of, you know, something as complicated as the environment over an area of 72 counties. No, there is there's a necessity for the scale of an organization. And certainly, can you find efficiencies? Of course you can. You can in any organization, any section of any organization. But I think the larger reality is that you have this this juggernaut that is kind of being derailed, and I think, I would argue, slowly dismantled. So I've got a story that my father-in-law, a Norwegian pastor, would always say. He talked about a farmer who was trying to wean his pig from food, and he said, I gave him a little less every day, a little less every day, and I almost had him weaned, and then he died. So it's kind of, I mean, what's going on, if you starve the body politic, if you sort of stem the flow of funds to agencies like the DNR, there will be you know, kind of a death of the effort. So these, in my opinion, are self-inflicted wounds. You know, if we value the environment and everything from the Knowles Nelson Stewardship Fund to wardens, you know, who are enforcing game laws, you know, common sense game laws, I think that is an expense for the common good that we all need to shoulder. So I think the emphasis on tax cutting, you know, tight budgetary times, yes, but again, those are that's a chosen term. It's kind of a chosen environment. We can do better. We can do otherwise.
Let's go to Greg in Milwaukee. Hi, Greg.
Hello. Hey, I'd like to say this. When I was a child, what I just said before, when I was a child, I could walk across the street and see bronze, coppers, hair streaks, dainty sulfurs, yellow. I would run up the puddles and just make the yellow clouds burst off. After there was a rainstorm, all the little yellow sulfurs would land and suck up the juice. They're gone. I mean, all this stuff is gone. And this was just in the suburbs of Milwaukee, and it's all gone. The tadpoles, the frogs were everywhere. Now the fish are losing their food. When you were, and I've worked in microbiology and bacteriology and mycology, and when you want to raise funguses, viruses, and bacteria, you raise the CO2 in the environment. We're doing that to the earth. And if we don't get these Republicans out of office, our children are going to suffer such a bad, bad. The ramifications of our actions are terrible.
And so, John, what are the ecological changes we are seeing around the state? And there's also been at issue chronic wasting disease.
Chronic wasting disease certainly is a potential danger to human wealth, human health, as well as the white-tailed deer herd. But I think the larger changes going on are very certainly climatic, and there are climate change deniers in the state legislature and certainly in the ranks of the administration as well. And I think there is only one right answer, and we will know it. And I think we'll know it before we realize. And I think you have 97% of the world scientists saying that there is climate change. It is accelerating. It is perhaps at this point unstoppable. It's important to pay attention. You know, as I've said, we believe the scientists when they say the sun is 93 million miles away, but when it comes to climate change, maybe not. Maybe you know, we're entitled to our alternative facts, which I think is deeply troubling,
Well, Greg, thank you for calling in and sharing your observations there. Let's go now to Sarah in Wanakee. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, I just kind of want to start this with the whole idea of the DNR might have been a victim of their own success. So as people became more invested in the idea of the DNR enforcing all these regulations, they also were writing tickets for people, you know, the average Joe fishing without a license. And so then there kind of became this view of them like, well, the Department of No Reason. They have no reason to be doing this. They have no value. They're issuing these. What might be seen as like invalid tickets or something that really isn't, you know, really that important. So then when it starts becoming defunded, people are like, well, that's fine. It's the Department of No Reason. They've had no value because all I've ever heard are these BS stories about, you know, this guy got a ticket for fishing without a license or, you know, this farmer got a ticket for this or whatever. So.
Sarah, thank you so much for calling in. John, your reaction?
I think certainly it's a human agency. And as such, you know, I'm not claiming by any means that the DNR, compared to any other human agency, is a galaxy of saints. Certainly there may have been bureaucratic overstep and overreaching. But I think it's really critical to underline that even though there may have been instances when people did feel they were being unfairly ticketed, the larger reality is that this is the agency that enforces the regulations and is the protector. of the resources that we need to pass on as intact as we possibly can to the people who come after us. So you take that apart, and it becomes simply a free-for-all.
John, do we know where public opinion stands on spending state money to protect the environment?
We certainly do. There was a 2015 study, and it was very intestinally, both Republican and Democratic, and the people responding, and it was 90% of the respondents thought that it was important to spend additional conservation funding to put aside land, even in times of fiscal stringency. So this was not simply something people looked at as a luxury, kind of the Cadillac option. Wisconsinites think of this as their birthright, and I think it's being threatened.
Let's take another call now. Dan in Fitchburg. Hi, Dan.
Good afternoon. I want to thank you both very much for talking about this critical issue. I'll try to say a lot quickly. So I have worked with DNR folks as a volunteer and also with the agency as an LTE, and I have been very, very impressed with the integrity of these people. They've been jerked around as different reorganizations happen, and what they are attempting to do of taking care of our fundamental needs for the environment is critical. Once you get to the point of having polluted water, bad air, and you've got your landscape covered with invasives, basically we've damaged our home. And we need to understand that the bureaucrats have their head in the sand and their hands in other people's pocketbooks, and these things need to stop. We need the public to pay attention to what's going on, because we're being stolen from.
Dan, thank you so much. John, how does big business also factor in with what Dan is saying here and its role in Wisconsin?
It's a large question, but I think Gaylord Nelson's line that the economy does not depend on the environment. The economy, actually, what he said, is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment. So I don't think by any means there is mutual exclusion between good business and big business and good environmental practices. No, there are numerous firms in Wisconsin who are doing their best to mitigate their impacts on the environment. But I think in the current dispensation is kind of, as you see so many cases of wetland conversions, permits for deep aquifer wells, where the motion, the direction is away from keeping the environment safe for us to keeping the environment safe for business, which I think is the wrong way to go.
So in years when state revenue is tight and there's lots of other competing sectors that need funding, how do you think the environment should figure into our debates?
I think the environment should be a critically important part of our debate, and I think we should reject the notion that all we want is lower taxes. And what has happened to government in not just Wisconsin but around the country is that there was a time in Milwaukee and Wisconsin when government was felt to be a fundamentally cooperative us, and all these things were our common wealth. And that, I think of that as two words. And what's happened, and it's just the last 15 years or so, is that whole notion of government has been turned around, so now we think of it as kind of a predatory them. So that us and them mentality really needs to be turned around, and we need to kind of reclaim that tradition of the Wisconsinites have always held dear. We do this for all of us. We have these state parks. We buy these natural areas. We take care of the roadsides and the natural areas and try to keep out the invasives as a benefit to all of us and to future generations as well.
And very quickly here as we wrap up, what can ordinary everyday people do as they watch how this situation unfolds in politics and in the environment?
Well, I think certainly there are common sense things to do as trying to mitigate our impact on the climate, certainly, as we can do as recyclers and reducing, reusing, recycling. But I think in terms of the DNR, this is a politically politicized agency, and since that's the root of the problem, the root of the solution has to be political as well, and that means putting as much pressure as we possibly can on our legislators, the Walker administration.
And I'm going to have to leave it there, John. Thank you so much for joining us. He's a Milwaukee writer and historian talking about his concerns that the state is putting the environment at risk.
Some big news from space. From space, on the planet Jupiter, to be precise.
NASA just released new images from the Juno probe orbiting around Jupiter. The new pictures focus in on the Great Red Spot. That's the massive storm that's been moving around the planet for at least 180 years, maybe longer.
The storm is big enough to hold two Earths, with maybe enough room left over for another one.
The close-up images from the probe could help to answer questions like, why is it so big? Why is it red? Is it changing over time? And how has it lasted so long?
The Great Red Spot has been continuously storming since 1830, possibly way longer. A spot had been detected on Jupiter in the late 1600s and early 1700s, but nobody's quite sure if that's the same spot or one that went away and then another one came along.
And we have an image and a link to more pictures from NASA on the Central Time Facebook page.
I think if you surveyed people and said, hey, name one feature on a planet other than Earth in our solar system, that red spot would be the first thing that come to mind, right?
It gets some play, yeah, for many generations.
And I remember, you know, on the walls of my, I think, sixth grade class were pictures of all the planets, and that got the attention, and we called it the Cylon planet, because the old Battlestar Galactica Cylons had the red eye dot that moved back and forth. So a fascinating bit of space. Great pictures on the Central Time Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network.